couldn't find fare. And a lot of the boats that had been to the cold storage and the swims came up there. I would fish there for the winter. I didn't fish there that winter myself, but I fished some in the spring, and the next summer, fish was low. I was one that was going for captive, and up at the co-op, they couldn't pay the price that they could to the cold storage, so the cold storage paid more. Well, naturally, I went back to the cold storage because I got 3 cents then for catfish. And then the co-op kept shifting around from hand to hand. Slim had it, and Pierce had it, and Pierce still had it in their hands when they weren't down. So that's what happened.
Well, I might Hastings, that's true.
You were in the office at that
very
time.
Well acquainted with it because I was cousin in the office. And I remember distinctly that when B.J. Pache was the candidate for this area federally, that he told us that he would intercede, if he were elected, that he would intercede, he's Judge Pache now, he would intercede to get freezing facilities, refrigeration facilities for the co-op.
Yeah.
And I believe, on my best information, that the final word on that was that he was informed by the other fish companies that there was adequate refrigeration for fish in Lockport, and for that reason the government couldn't come forth and give us any facilities.
Yes.
Did people in the town know you were from the U.S. that came here in 1939?
I beg your pardon, I didn't get it.
Did the people of the town, when you first came here in 1939, did the people of the town know you were from the Union? Did all the people in the town know you were from the Union?
Well, I don't know, but all the people in the town. But I would say that at the first original meeting that where I appeared, that the majority of the Lockport fishermen were at the meeting, and man, there was you know, it was quite open. Go on.
Well, the person I asked, they said that they accused you of being a thief, and said that you stole the fish from the money. Is that true, or did they?
Oh, I don't remember anything about that.
Look, some.
This person told me, they said that they called you, accused you of being a thief, and said you skipped town with the money.
Yeah, actually.
Left
hand and her report was even more. Yeah, well, look, if there was any money around here, I didn't know about it. I'll tell you, Principal mentions the co-op, and this was really a wonderful thing. And I felt so strongly about it that I borrowed $25 from my father and I put it into the co-op.
Well,
still there.
Where would this person get the idea that you left town with some money?
Look, this is one of the things. You know, there's only so much pie. And if the employees organize a union and they want a bigger slice of the pie, somebody takes less. And the people who have been getting practically the whole pie all along, they want to continue getting practically the whole pie. And most of them will stop at absolutely nothing, including lies. No, I mean, it's one of those things. Look, you might have a legitimate question. I was back and forth in Lockport until September 1940. I went home and I didn't come back. The reason I didn't come back was there was a Mountie who put his hand on my shoulder and said, come with me, you're picked up under the Defense of Canada regulations. I said, what's that mean? He said, what are they? He said, it's under Section 23. I said, what's Section 23? He said, I don't know, but it doesn't really make any difference.
Does the town people know that the Canada came for this
I don't know how soon they found out, or if they ever did, for that matter. Because for the next 16 months, my wife was not getting money from Lockport. She was getting $1.80 a week for herself and the two kids under Halifax County Relief. And when I got out of the camp, I had to get a job on account of her relief would be cut off. Eh? So I went to work in Halifax in the shipyards, the first job I could get. Yeah. From the first to the last, I was, by and large, my headquarters were the Hillcrest Hotel in Lockport. I left Lockport to have meetings all along the shore. In fact, I bought a new car, and I noticed that in 10 weeks I put 11,000 miles on it. And part of that 10 weeks was the 9 weeks or so that the lock was in force in Lockport. So I wasn't here all the time, 100 minutes. And I don't know all the things went on in the picket line. Because the picket captains, who were Lockport men, sometimes said, look, I think perhaps it's advisable for you not to be around today. Or if you're around today, stay in the hotel. These things happened. The wages? Ask Mr. Williams.
I would request you to expand your answer. Just tell us generally about the conditions of the workers before the lockdown.
The conditions of the lockdown, because American managers did now, and some of the people there, 15 cents an hour for cutting fish. During the lockout, you was lucky, Mr. Dwight Ringer, he was the Secretary Treasurer and an honest man, and everything is documented, like Mr. Murray said there, unions, every cent is recorded, everything is documented there, and you can't misuse the funds. I know, because I was a regional vice president for Canadian Seafood Workers Union, I was president for this one here for a good long time, and I know the mechanism, how it operates. If you want to switch your line, you've got a $2 slip that the union supplier of the West Coast has sent. The tax line, and then that item is called a split fund. Since that time, they changed a little bit involved in the tax line. So if you're lucky, you've got a $2 slip signed with stamp from Mr. Murray and Pat Sullivan. And when you go to these two stores in Lockport, and honored those in the Mr. Charlie Valleys and McKinsey Brothers. You go there, and I don't think possibly they never got paid for some of the check. They wouldn't let you start it yet, and that's how things went. And on the picket line, there was things that happened there that I wouldn't tell you. You wouldn't know. And then when they sent approximately 60 Mounties in here to, if necessary, shoot you and beat you off of the track, grab you like that there, and you was charged, what's your name? You was charged with obstructing the police if you hit them. Now, some people can't stand the people lay their hands on you, especially if you're a young man, 20 years old like that. So you do the next best thing, and then you're charged with obstructing police, and you can get 2 to 5 years for it. And so some of the charges, that was when it was laid, were my father and Mr. Stewart. They knew the charges had been laid, and they asked Angus L. McDonald and McCorry, I think his name was at that time, if there was any charges laid that they withdrawn. He said he would if they go back to work. So they went back to work on the conditions that they would take the former employees back as rapidly as conditions would work, and they would get the order, we thought would be the same union. But anyway, they got a company union, which was called the ERU, Employees Reconstruction Union, that was called. But we wasn't long find a better name for that. Every rat's union, because that's what it was. I speak frankly because I'm brutal. I don't know any other way. I didn't get any information. So I can only speak that way. So conditions was bad in this that's the conditions that you worked under. So you had nothing to lose, you had nowhere to go, you couldn't get no down, no lower. There where you was. I was a married man then, a young married man then, two children. So, and living in a hired house. And them conditions, maybe you wonder sometimes what you do. You say, I do this or I do that. But you don't know at times when the orders was nothing in or nothing out to France. That meant nothing in. And the CNR, Happy Lennox, and Murray Richardson, two men that I know well, got great respect and admiration for, they would bring the train down to their reunion. They wore it on their coveralls and they got their reunion men. They'd come down and the train, they tell us, they'd blow the whistle. And the housewives would go sometime, all your head would break, most of them, and they'd leave Bernie and they'd come down and stand on the picket line. And he'd come so far, we'd stand with the flag between the cars, and the head people would say, take her in, take the cars out. They'd have them loaded up with fishermen. And they thought they'd break us. And we'd stand between the couplings of cars, and Happy Lennox and Murray Bishop would say, that's as far as I'm taking her. You want to go, take her. And they'd take her out. They never took anything. Captain Norman Smith, he was a blockade runner in the First War, and he was a man with a lot of guts, as you'd say it. And he came down to swing one time to get a load of stuff out of the place, and I was on the captain of the picket at that time, Wes McKenzie and Edwin Bennett, which I got, he was a sticker right through the... So we stayed there, and he said he was coming through. And we told him he couldn't get through. We had quite a lot of pickets on the line there, and then we thought they'd all escape. But we didn't think that he'd run us down. And that's exactly what he'd have done with a great big truck. He would have ran right over the top of us. And we split. Wes McKenzie jumped on one side and I jumped on the other. And we had the wires off and had it over to Mr. Ophir Stevens' people. But he got out. And when he told us to see him afterwards, Bert Crowe was driving the truck. He's still alive up in Sheldon. We asked him sometimes. And he got her out. And he said, boys, I want you back. Another time, they loaded a big transport truck with glue and fish meal, and the driver there was going to upset that, and he take it off, took it off and didn't get out. But a few weeks since then, a couple of them run, Harry Hicks and another brother down, my brother down, dragged them on the car, taking stuff out of the place, and I looked like that. Those were the conditions you worked on. And some of the other things that I wouldn't tell you what happened, and I don't know at all because it was a big place from the fish meal plant down the swim, the whole waterfront. So when you was on that thing, you didn't know what happened. But some of the things happened afterwards. And there's Mounties, there was about 60 of them, approximately 60, I didn't count them, but approximately that many were here. And one fellow had been on the West Coast, he had a pistol on him there, and when it got kind of rough, he was going to draw that. And one of the other Mounties said to him, my God, don't do that. That's the words he said. And he put it back, and he'd been on the West Coast. But if he only knew that I knew that there was rifles, I doubt they'd be talking about this co-op with a big magazine into it, the old war rifles, and if the riot had struck, the Mounties would have got the... And the people, most of the people, was on our side. Fishermen 100%, and most of the people was on the workers' side because they know that the conditions they worked under. And I can tell you, say, I'm not going to weary you, but you can get a report of it. Some of the things that I personally would know, somebody else could tell you some other things that happened to some of the places around, but it wasn't a very pleasant thing. It's history now, it's water under the bridge, and you've gone through it somehow, but you almost lost your independence, lost everything, every bit of honor that probably you had. Some of them did, had to go and get almost down your knees to get something for the kids to eat, you can buy a sandwich. And if you left it out of the history of Lockport, you'd be unfair. It happened. And it could happen. We say these things, we read history, so it don't happen again. But the concentration camps in Germany and these places, don't want that to happen again. We don't want that. Organized labor only wants a fair shake, which I'm 100% back with. I've been on both sides of the table. I was a supervisor for 13 years down the National. I sat there as like the line on the road. I wouldn't tear the fender off your car if you give me half the road. That's all I want. All you want is a fair chance to make a living. That's all the people ask for. And like I said, I sit on both sides of the table. Now I'm on the Municipal School Board and on the Lockport School, and I do business with the teachers, the contracts. I like to see them get a fair shake. If the cost of living goes up 8%, you only give them 6, you're going 2% behind. I'm not very much of a mathematician, but I know that much. And all they want is a fair shake. That's all anybody wants. And I had a lot of respect for human nature. There's a lot of, if it wasn't a lot of good people, we couldn't live, we couldn't survive in this world. So if you left the history of Lot for that Lot out, you wouldn't be fair.
Look, there are two kinds of justice. Hey? There are two kinds of justice. Actually, the fishermen and fish handlers had the law on their side, but they had the attorney general. The attorney general was on the side of the companies, and the companies won because of that. The companies broke the law when they locked out the fishermen. All right, do you believe that you can break the law or not break the law?
You can break it if you want to.
Yeah, you can break it if you want to. And if you know you've got the government and the attorney general on your side, you know you're going to get away with it. So that's fine. Look, I will say here and now, you remember a couple of thousand years ago there was a guy generally drawn with a picture with a nice spade beard and all that sort of thing? Made some statements which are very, very true. By their fruit ye shall know them, and all that sort of thing. No, Jesus Christ. And if he had arrived in Lockport at that time and started organizing the fishermen, well, way back 2,000 years ago, they crucified him.
Hey? They did.
Yeah, they did. The companies in Lockport at that time would, if they wouldn't be able to crucify him, so what they would have done is lock out the fishermen. Period. That's it. Look, in the concentration camp, somebody asked me about this, how important, and apparently it's very, very important to you, whether I was a communist or not. At the time, it was not important to the fishermen in Lockport. It was important to the fish companies because they could use this as a weapon to beat the fishermen. Hey? That was why it was important to them, and the only reason it was important to them. Look, I had a hearing, which I was entitled to 16 months before I got it, according to the law of Canada, the Defense War Measures Act. Finally, I had a hearing. In that hearing, nobody at any time said, are you a communist? Nobody said, were you a communist? Nobody said, are you going to be a communist? What they did say is, do you think that the Fishermen's Union in Lockport is sufficiently broken that it can't be revived again now? That's what they asked me. And that was what they were interested in. And that's why I was in a concentration camp. Period. That's it. And if I had been, instead of being just Charlie Murray, if I had been Jesus Christ, it would have been the same thing. And they would have called him a communist. Of course, he was just as much of a communist as I was. When you come to think of it, he said, go sell all that you have and give it to the poor. What? Well, you know?
It makes no difference to me whether or not you're a communist. It's just that you were being a communist at that time had an effect on fishermen.
Didn't make a part.
When they tried to set up a cooperative, according to several sources, they were denied this chance to set up a cooperative legally.
Just a minute. This is not correct. It's not correct. Look, one time, the Protestant clergyman who was active in the cooperative movement, which was controlled by St. FX and the Catholic Church, They built the cooperatives in Nova Scotia. The cooperative in Lockport when it started to organize, I got on the telephone and I called up John Donald Nelson MacDonald, who was minister at the south end of Dartmouth, Woodside, at the time. I called him up and said, Nelson, because we were on a first name basis. Said, Nelson, look, there's a co-op going to be a co-op organized here. How much help and support can you give us in organizing a co-op? He said, I'll take it up with the directors. That's the last we ever heard of it. Because at that particular time, the Catholic Church was not outstanding in the work they were doing in organizing fishermen, period. And they felt that building a co-op and helping to build a co-op in Lockport was anti-company, and they were not anti-company. Look, I would like to say, we haven't got even another minute.
Time is pretty well run out.
Yeah.
So I'd like to finish what you're saying, Mr.
No, I was going to say that, look, the building of the co-op, and there's one guy who didn't get any credit and who deserves a lot of credit, is a gentleman, by the name of G.H. Whiteman, who owned the property and the cannery up at the on the shore there. And it was he who recommended and suggested that a co-op be built. And he offered to sell his property for not $1,000, but for $5,000. I doubt if he ever got the whole of the $5,000. You can get the story here about how a mill was donated and the lumber was donated and ox teams were donated and horse teams were donated. They cut the wood in the woods, they hauled it to the mill, they sawed it into planks, they hauled the piles here, they drove them by hand. There was a pile driver lying idle in the harbor, but the fishermen couldn't get it. So they built, improvised a pile driver where 20 men hauled up the weight and let it drop, and they hauled it up and let it drop. And they built the wharf, and some of the fishermen started to fish, and some of the fish handlers started to cut the fish. And the fish were shipped to Cape Breton and bought by the union men in Cape Breton as a support. Well, they got good fish for a good price, but this was support to the Lockport fishermen. And this was really an hit.